Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, pairing beer and music since 1988. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago, Illinois. Listen critically, enjoy responsibly.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and later in the show, we're going to hear from Grammy nominees The Black Pumas about the songs that made them decide to pursue a life in music. But first, we're looking at the shady side of music.
That's right, Greg. We've gathered our favorite songs about low-down, no-good scoundrels. But to get us started, we're going to talk with someone well-versed in shady characters in music, Jake Brennan, host of the hit podcast Disgraceland. Jake is actually focusing on the real-life misdeeds and questionable activities of musicians. Some of them may have inspired the characters we're going to talk about in song. But he describes Disgraceland as a blend of music history, true crime, and transgressive fiction. Jake, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Stoked to be here with you guys. Thanks for having me.
So, Jake, we want to get philosophical. Unlike Hollywood, right, we've seen plenty of actors who've done something really questionable, sometimes criminal, right? And then the fans kind of fall away. The supporters fall away. Hollywood certainly falls away, stops casting them, right? In music, it seems that often criminal or immoral actions, if you will, 20 years of reporting on R. Kelly has made me ponder this question. You know, is the fact that some of the stuff he did was so reprehensible and or criminal, is that part of the appeal? So here you have this show that is devoted to these in-depth tellings of misdeeds and sometimes criminal actions by famous musicians and other characters. And is that part of what music fans like?
I think so. I think it's the criminality, at least the bad behavior, is baked into the cake, as they say. And I feel as though the music industry was a different place in the 1970s, 1980s, even in the 90s than it is now. And a lot of this behavior was accepted. Record labels, and I'm not trying to say this from a high and mighty point of view at all, but record labels excused a lot of behavior just to compete and sell records. And I think this sort of myth of the rock star grew up, sort of in the latter part of the 20th century, and it was accepted. It's celebrated. I mean, to call somebody a rock star is like a way to praise somebody. Oh, you're a rock star. You know, you did good at your job. You're a rock star.
And it's across genres. I mean, R&B and soul and funk and rock and certainly hip hop. None of these genres has had a lack of criminal behavior.
Right. I mean, Rick James is one of the most criminal minded musicians I've ever come across. Everything from his mom was dealing drugs to jazz guys when he was a little kid to eventually he's helping the Colombian cartel smuggle drugs into the States to, everything that went down with the abduction of the women and the crack. I mean, it's just like his whole life is marked by true crime in some way or another. Yet he creates this style of funk that is totally unique and, sells like crazy.
So what you're saying, Jake, is that Tipper Gore was right all along. This is going to corrupt the youth of America. Because these are despicable human beings and they, they are infesting the minds of our young people at an impressionable age.
Exactly. Yes. What Tipper Gore left out, however, was that it's wildly entertaining stuff. And just from a storytelling perspective, for me, I mean, these guys, the way I don't do what you guys do, I couldn't pretend to do it. You guys are real, journalists and music historians. And I'm a storyteller. I try to look at these guys in the same way that John Ford would look at cowboys or Martin Scorsese would look at gangsters. They're wildly entertaining characters that I'm trying to tell their stories and be as entertaining as possible in a way that does their stories justice.
Well, the famous John Ford quote, when the legend gets bigger than reality, repeat the legend. Mm-hmm. There's an element of that. Lester Bangs, to put it in one of my favorites, in rock and roll, there is no fact, only myth, right? But, Jake, some of the misdeeds, the Ramones throwing television sets out the window and almost hitting passersby in Queens. Okay, we can kind of show the almost being the key if someone had died. But some of the things, Jerry Lee Lewis allegedly being a killer more than that nickname with one of his later wives. It's a sad story, and it's a horrible story. He's never tried. He's never indicted. He never pays a price for that. Do you feel at all an element of like exploitation in dealing with, some would say celebrating, these horrible incidents in the lives of great artists that makes them a little less great to plenty of people.
Yeah, I don't feel as though at Disgraceland we're celebrating the actual misdeeds more than, you know, I can separate the art from the artist in most cases. And I'm very critical of Jerry Lee Lewis in that episode of his behavior. You know, I mean, I wink and nod at sort of his badass image and the whole thing about wanting to assassinate Elvis Presley. I mean, that is funny to me, whether or not he did or did not kill his wife. And I think the evidence is pretty clear one way or another, which what happened there. But it doesn't, none of that erases the fact that, you know, I'm going to put on Live at the Star Club with Jerry Lee Lewis and the Nashville Teens playing behind him, and it's going to make me drive 100 miles per hour.
It's as good as rock and roll gets.
It's so good. It's incredible. But, you know, it's also interesting. You know, I can't completely objectify it because with some artists, for some reason, it's a lot different. You know, I don't know why, but, I'm not like a Ryan Adams junkie or whatever, but I haven't listened to a Ryan Adams record since that whole thing came out. But I don't hold that same standard to when I hear Thriller come on, and I don't know why. I mean, it's just the way it is. So to answer your question, in the telling of these stories, I think it's pretty clear that I'm separating the musician from the music. And in most cases, I have a deep reverence for a lot of this music, and I can't hide that. And it doesn't really, it's not really going to change, you know?
Yeah, I think it's one of those slippery slopes that will ever forever be slippery. Because it's so ill-defined. There is no right or wrong sometimes. It's just kind of this huge gray area where there's good and bad. And I think it's up to each listener, each fan. I'm curious what kind of feedback you get from the people who are listening to your show. What are they listening for, and what are they getting out of it? What is your sense of your audience?
You know, there's something about this, the medium of podcasting, where these stories... The main reaction that I get from fans and have gotten from day one when I released that Jerry Lee Lewis episode as the first episode was really like, holy cow, I can't believe this happened. And that was my reaction when I read that story 20 years ago in a Rolling Stone anthology or wherever I read it. And, you know, all these stories are out there. And oftentimes, like I just got done researching Ray Charles and I wrote the Ray Charles episode. And the stuff that Ray Charles cops to in his autobiography is shocking, and it's been out there for years. And it's, but you know, it's in a book, so it's different. And it's not like, well, people, I'm not trying to say people don't read, it's just there's something just more jarring about it when you cram it into this 30-minute guy's telling you a story in your ear, and you know, it's kind of like pummeling you with these incidents that have taken place. I don't know what that is, but to answer your question, the reaction I most get is shock.
So how do you define transgressive fiction or storytelling versus journalism?
Well, journalism is clearly people who are going out there and they're sourcing stuff on their own, and they're generating stories based on their investigative resources and the work that they're doing. That is not what I do at all. Mm-hmm. Everything that I am doing, I've been clear about this from day one, is based on stories that are already out there, oftentimes directly from the musicians' mouths themselves and their autobiographies. I'm very clear about what is factual and what is where I'm using creative license. I don't, you know, I may depict a event that happened between an artist and someone else, and I may actually, you know, use creative license to bring that to life, but I'm not inventing events out of thin air that did not happen. And I haven't been challenged on that because, you know, I haven't gone beyond whatever line that is. And I try to adhere to just, you know, the basic rules of storytelling. And I'm not trying to misrepresent these artists in any way. And I think if I was out there trying to pretend to be an investigative journalist or a journalist of any kind, there'd be a different result, but I'm not.
Do you, you're pretty confident that the audience knows the difference. I mean, I'm thinking of a rather innocuous tale in one of the two Beatles episodes. George and John's dentist dose them at dinner one night. And the first acid trip they have is a freak out because they weren't expecting to take it. And they were driving around in the Aston Martin in London. And having written a book about psychedelic rock with a chapter on the Beatles, that is everything I know about that incident. But the way you tell the story, it's about 10 minutes long, and there are lights and streaks and sounds. And I think, you know, one of them is hearing the chants from the Wizard of Oz flying monkeys in their head. Now, all of this, having done my research, my friend, on the psychedelic experience, all of this is quite possible, but we don't know that it happened.
Right. We don't know that it happened. We don't know that it didn't happen either.
Right. I'm willing to grant that, you know.
And I've done acid before, and I'm sure you guys have or have know people who have, and all kinds of stuff happens. And again, nothing like everything that happens in that scene that you're depicting, like everything from when they're at the dentist's house and they're listening to Burt Bacharach. I mean, that happened. That's in Peter Brown's book. You know, he was very impressed with the dentist's wife. They were driving in a Mini Cooper. The conversation that was going on in the back seat between Patty Harrison and Cynthia Lennon was their reaction was accurate. That's all from, like I said, from Peter Brown's book. I trust Peter Brown. He knew those guys clearly. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not going to be making stuff up when he's telling the story. And I'm giving the story color when I talk about you know tracers that are going by and hear and filling things out with audio design, because that's what happens when you do acid.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm willing to grant you that license as a storyteller. You know, you bring that scene to very vivid life. But I can understand why then you wouldn't want to do Marilyn Manson. This license we give musicians to mythologize themselves, and we sort of, like 13-year-old boys, chuckle at misbehavior, and then we find out that wasn't a myth, that was reality. It can be troublesome, and no wonder so many people are unaware of actual bad behavior. I mean, it was no secret that Phil Spector could be violent. He was shooting guns off for 25, 30 years, and then he finally killed someone.
Right, exactly. Just like, I mean, you know firsthand, the R. Kelly thing, just like the Bill Cosby thing, like that stuff was out there in the ether. Like we knew it, we heard of it. I mean, there's not one example in any of my episodes where I'm celebrating misogyny or the bad behavior of men towards women. In fact, I make a point to point it out, even in cases when it has nothing to do with the story. Like you can't, that's why in that Bowie episode, I have to mention Lori Maddox, because somebody's going to bring it up. It's the same thing in the Led Zeppelin episode. And there's that sort of rock star, like, you know, we're going to bang a bunch of chicks. That's not what Disgraceland is about. It's never been what it's about. Again, I'm not a journalist, so I can have whatever editorial point of view I want. And clearly I've been critical of that stuff.
I don't think I've missed it, but when do we get the 6-part episode on the Eagles?
Right after I do the 18-part episode on the Fleetwood Mac.
We've been talking to Jake Brennan, the writer, host, and producer of Disgraceland. Jake, thanks so much for illuminating us about your show.
Awesome to be here, guys. Thank you so much. I love the show. I just want to let you know that the Todd Rundgren episode had me reaching for my Utopia to Face the Music vinyl copy. So thanks for that.
Have you listened to Disgraceland? So what do you think? Leave us a voice message at our website. Coming up, we're going to share our favorite songs about fictional shady characters. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island, brewing Chicago-inspired beers since 1988. Our friends at Goose Island have award-winning, refreshing beverages ranging from hazy IPAs to the new 312 Lemonade Shandy, only available in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner in crime is Greg Kot, and we are ready to celebrate some transgressive fiction. Songs about villainous scoundrels, no good, rotten people.
Yes, Erykah Badu is not a rotten person, Jim. I'm going to kick us off here with this, but the person she is singing about in Tyrone definitely is. You know, one of the things I miss about concerts is going to see people like Erykah Badu on stage, because she is a magnetic performer who is into improv and making stuff up on stage. It's sort of a spontaneity.
Very theatrical.
Going to see shows, is part of that experience. An artist like her, she owns that stage. And while the story goes with Tyrone, one of her biggest hits was not did not appear on her debut album, but did appear on a live record that she issued afterward, is that she essentially made up the song on stage. It was an improvisation over an instrumental backing by her excellent band, and freestyled these lyrics. And she was singing in the song about her boyfriend, but the Tyrone that is mentioned in the track is not the boyfriend. So you're saying, why are you bringing him up? Well, here, it's kind of a layered story. She is kicking this guy out for being a layabout. He's a lazy guy. Every time he comes over, it's not just her and the boyfriend. It's the boyfriend and his crew, you know? Yeah. Three or four guys always coming over. And I go, why are you bringing these guys over all the time? Yeah. You seem to be attached to these guys so much. Why don't you get them to help you move out? Because I'm kicking your butt out of my house. So she said, why don't you call Tyrone and get him over here to help you move your stuff?
Tyrone is a member of the crew.
So Tyrone is not only a member of the crew, but she's implying that he's not only a friend of the bad boyfriend, but also an enabler. You know, he's a guy, he sees what's going on, but he's not telling this guy, hey, listen, you know, she deserves your attention. We shouldn't be here. So sort of a freeloader, an enabler, and just as bad as the bad boyfriend in many ways. So Tyrone gets the title of the song, and for good reason, according to Erykah Badu. Here's Tyrone from Erykah Badu on Sound Opinion.
Every time we go somewhere, I gotta reach down in my purse to pay your way and your homeboy's way, and sometimes your car. Stars. Like Badu, I'ma tell you the truth. Showing proof, booking the fool. I think you better call him and tell him. But you can't use my phone.
That is Tyrone from Erykah Badu on Sound Opinions, one of my songs about a scoundrel.
Yeah.
What do you got for us, Jim?
I'm going to start us off with two covers, Greg. And the first is a cover of a song by Mr. Bob Dylan. When I famously got fired at Rolling Stone, went down in flames for panning Hootie and the Blowfish. You know, the song that kept going through my head for a good 6 months was, I ain't going to work on Jan Wenner's farm no more. I was rewriting Maggie's Farm. You know, you look at that classic from 1965 from Dylan's Bringing It All Back Home, and there's not one, there's not two, there are three scoundrels, all part of the 1%, the capitalist boss, the worst kind of boss. Maggie treats Dylan as the employee character quite badly. But even worse is the way that her brother and her pa treat him. This is not a family you'd want to be working for on Maggie's farm. And Bob says, I ain't going to work on Maggie's farm no more. Of course, it's one of those great 60s anti-the-man songs, right? And Dylan, meanwhile, he's got a head full of ideas driving me insane. He's going to get out of Maggie's farm. He's going to start working on those ideas. It was covered by the great R&B artist Solomon Burke. Many covers of this song over the years, but taking it into the soul R&B realm, I think does something very different, because we all think about, you know, the horrible life of itinerant farmers and even slaves, you know. But Solomon's jaunty celebration of the song focuses not on the villainous, you know, or Maggie, pa, and brother, but on the joy he has of being able to strike out on his own. So this is Solomon Burke's version of Maggie's Farm.
Well, he put
thoughts laying around his doors. Liberty, I ain't gonna work for Maggie's Paw no more.
Oh, Maggie's Farm. It's a great song. It's great in Solomon's hands. Was great in Dylan's. Do you know that cover?
I do. I love Solomon Burke. I love that choice.
Yeah. What a singer.
He's a great singer. You know, the idea of villains in songs is so long-standing. You know, they become celebrated. They almost become a larger-than-life characters in themselves. Sometimes they're totally made up. In this case, there's a kind of a mixture of myth and true-to-life reality. Stagger Lee may be one of the top five, maybe the top most well-known folk songs of the last century and a half.
Yeah,
It is written about a real-life murder in the late 80s by one Stag Lee Shelton in St. Louis.
You're talking about the 1880s.
Yes, the 1880s, yes. And he killed a man named Billy Lyons in a card game. And there was a dispute in a card game, and they ended up getting into a fight. Stag Lee Shelton pulled a gun on Billy and shot him dead. Went to prison for his crime. Got out of prison eventually, and then went back into prison a year later and for another crime that he had committed, and then eventually died in prison. Mm. But anyway, the legend grew. Like, it became a huge... it was one of those scandalous occurrences that first consumed the Midwest, where it happened in St. Louis, and then became known all around the United States. It became a field holler. It started in the plantations with the workers singing about this legend, and then was turned into a song by people like Mississippi John Hurt and later Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, Woody Guthrie did versions of it. The most popular version may be the Lloyd Price hit in 1959, but it is a completely watered-down version.
Ah.
Spares us all the blood and guts and gore and nastiness in the song.
Now, murder ballads should be visceral.
Yes, absolutely. And that is what the Rulers, the Jamaican rock steady band, understood. But they twisted the lyrics in the same fashion that the Grateful Dead and Nick Cave did when they covered the song. You know, giving the story their own spin, the Rulers put the spin on, you know, let's talk about this thing from Billy Lyons' point of view. He got cheated by this guy, you know. Stagger Lee was trying to cheat him in this game of cards. So Billy Lyon made the mistake of pulling a knife on Stagger Lee. Stagger Lee pulled out a gun.
You don't bring a knife to a gunfight.
Absolutely. No. That is rule number one of any kind of battle.
I came from Jersey.
Right?
I had it tattooed on my back.
Exactly. And the Clash heard that song. They loved it. They thought it was a terrific version of sort of turning that tale around and put it in the hands of the Tryon Man. If you're going to cheat me in a small game like this, imagine what you do to the people around you when things really count. You're cheating the Tryon Man. The Tryon Man being Billy Lyon, right?
So all right.
The Clash adapted that and turned it into one of the most iconic songs from that London Calling album in 1979. Wrong Amboyo, it's called, in the version that the Clash is doing based on the Rulers' original version of that Stagger Lee tale on Sound Opinions.
Why do you try to cheat? Come out on top. Don't you know it is wrong to keep it frying?
Long and Boyo. Yeah, that's a classic. The Clash bringing the Stagger Lee legend forward. Greg, I'm going to play another deep classic, Mac the Knife. You know, I have been reading a lot lately about the Weimar Republic, that explosion of creativity in art and architecture, sexuality, theater, music in Germany before the very bad sequel of the Nazi era. And, of course, leading lights in the theater and in the music world were Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht. And their Three Penny Opera debuts in 1928, just days before it's about to have its first staging. The actor playing Mac the Knife, a murderous character who, among other crimes, commits arson, robbery, rape. I want to make clear, we do not endorse this behavior. But look, you know, from the classics of literature to comic books to WandaVision, a lot of times the most interesting characters are do horrible, horrible things, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and Mac the Knife was, he was an assassin, no good. Weill had written the tune really quickly, and Bertolt Brecht provides the lyrics. They don't give it to Mac the Knife to sing, but another observer talking about this guy who has like shark teeth. Hmm. You know, everything about him is sharp and dangerous. In the many, 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 many versions of it that would follow the Weimar era, you know, of course, the biggest hit's Bobby Darin. A lot of people hate on that song because he smooths it out, makes it hipster jazz, you know. But I kind of like Bobby Darin. But you got to say, if ever there was one musician, you just mentioned him, who was born to sing Mac the Knife, it's Nick Cave.
That's true.
So, you know, there were two Hal Wilner produced tribute albums to the work of Brecht and Weill. September Songs was the collection that gave us Nick Cave's version of Mac the Knife, and it's just immortal, right down to that barrel organ. You know, it was in the original, it was propelled by this thing that was a cross between a small organ and an accordion, and that oompa oompa powers Nick Cave.
See the shark with teeth like razors, and he wears them in his face. And MacHeath has got a knife, but not in such an obvious place. Now see the shark, how red his fins are, as he slashes at his prey. Oh, Mac the Knife wears fancy gloves, which give the minimum away. By the Thames, turbid waters, men abruptly tumble down.
Nick Cave covered Mac the Knife. MacHeath was his name, hence Mac the Knife.
Yeah, you could see Nick Cave as a character in a Weimar Republic lounge back in the day, you know, cabaret.
Yeah. Nick Cave and Susie Sue are just the cast of the whole Weimar era.
Indeed. We're talking about bad people in songs about villainous characters, and I can't think of a greater villain than the title character in Goodbye Earl by the Chicks, then known as the Dixie Chicks.
Formerly
right?
The Dixie Chicks.
This song's got a great, interesting history because Dennis Lynn, the songwriter, had been writing hits in the Nashville pipeline since the early 70s. His first major hit was for Elvis Presley, Burning Love. That was his song.
Wow.
And later on, he had hits for Gary Morris and Don Williams and Eddie Raven and Mark Chestnut and Garth Brooks in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Goodbye Earl was a song that had sort of been hanging around for a decade. It was recorded, from what I can gather, once on a record that never got released around 1990 by a band that nobody remembers anymore. How the Chicks ended up finding this song and embracing it, I don't exactly know, but given what I do know about the Dixie Chicks that at that time, This is the one group in Nashville that would have taken this song head on and embraced it and said, we're going to go with this one.
Yeah.
Because it says a lot about abuse and about women who fight against it and how they can possibly deal with it. Now, there's a comedic side to it, a very darkly comedic side to it. You know, these high school friends conspire. You know, the one, it's the story of high school friends, Marianne and Wanda. Marianne goes off to conquer the world. Wanda stays home and meets this lousy guy, Earl.
Treats her badly.
Ends up putting her in the hospital. Marianne comes back to help out her friend. They concoct a plan to, well, you know, these black-eyed peas, we can put some extra seasoning on those. He loves those. Yeah. And next thing you know, Earl is 6 feet under. Right?
The old poison peas
and
trick.
It's kind of a Thelma and Louise kind of thing,
yeah.
You know? They're buddies since childhood, and they fought through and helped each other out when they needed each other the most. It's Goodbye Earl from the Chicks on Sound Opinion.
Well, it wasn't too.
Wow, Dixie Chicks, now the Chicks, Goodbye Earl. Earl is an infamous scoundrel and very bad character. You know, for my next pick, Greg, I'm going to give the lady some Nelly Furtado. What a great talent. Canadian singer, you know, has really dropped off the radar in the last couple of years, but a huge hit from her third studio album, Loose, in 2006 was this song, Maneater. And she is not decrying a character. She's kind of trying the role on, right?
Yeah, right.
She is. She was inspired by the Hall & Oates song, she said, both in the production style and kind of the music. But she takes it in a place of her own, portraying this woman who is a man-eater. Makes you spend hard, makes you want all her love, makes you buy cars, makes you cut the cards, right? Mm. Cheat, you know, do anything. She is addictive. Everybody get your neck to crack around, all you crazy young people, right? Look at this man-eater. You know, she's an enlightened, empowered woman, but she is talking about a character, and she really brings this frightening woman, this dangerous woman, this black magic woman. That was another one I was considering. She really brings that character to life. So Nelly Furtado, Manny.
Come on now. Man, it'll be.
Nelly Furtado, Maneater. Wow, we need a new Nelly Furtado album.
We do. Great. It's been years since we've heard from her. I thought she was a great artist.
Way too long. Coming up, we share more of our favorite songs about shady characters. And we'll hear from the Grammy-nominated Austin duo Black Pumas about the music that got them hooked on Sonics. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. He's Greg Cott. And this week, we are sharing some of our favorite songs about shady characters. Ne'er-do-wells. No good nicks. Exactly. There's so many words for bad people. Greg, you're next. What do you got?
Jim, this is kind of right up your alley because I know what a big Floydian you are.
I thought
Floydian.
About this song, but yes. I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yes. Well, you know, I think especially the Sid Barrett era. The Sid Barrett era for Pink Floyd was where it's at for me. And this was their first single, Arnold Lane. Sid Barrett, being the primary songwriter and vocalist in the band at the time, was coming up with these, let's just say, unconventional ideas for songs.
Yes.
Apparently the song grew out of the fact that they knew a person like Arnold Lane when he was growing up near Roger Waters.
Their
parents were friends. And there was this character in the neighborhood who used to, you know, steal women's laundry off the clothesline when it was hanging outside, and apparently wearing it.
Yeah, to wear it, yeah.
Yes.
See, I think the only thing wrong with that, because we were not judgmental on Sound Opinions, is the thievery.
Exactly, and that the song got banned from BBC Radio, not because of the thievery, okay, here's this guy who's a kleptomaniac, but because he was apparently a cross-dressing transvestite. And, you know, I think Sid Barrett's point here was that even though English society was painting this guy as a scoundrel and a villain and a bad dude, you know, he was not at all. In fact, what he was doing was illustrating in this song that this particular fetish is a little bit more widespread than some people may actually believe. They don't want to admit to themselves that this is going on in their society.
Well, you know,
but in fact, Barrett is saying,
Victorians,
yeah.
Those Victorians were quite a bunch.
So he's saying, you know, he came up with Arnold Lane. It's not the guy's actual name. He just came up with it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fictional name, but about a real occurrence in his neighborhood. And it's an everyday person who happens to indulge a fetish that is far more commonplace than British society would like to acknowledge. I think it's a protest song in a lot of ways, you know?
Well, Sid Barrett was wear your freak flag proudly and high.
Sid Barrett coming out of the gates hot, you know, with this song. Pink Floyd's Arnold Lane on Sound Opinions.
Arnold Lane had a strange.
Pink Floyd, a really big hit when it came out, despite being banned by the BBC. Greg, I have one more song. When you talk about memorable villainous characters in hip-hop, they are legion. But I think there are a few voices in the history of rap that have been better storytellers than Ghostface Killa of the Wu-Tang Clan. I mean, his novelistic eye for detail, his ability to mix both horror and crime and humor and sarcasm, he really is one of a kind. And I could have gone with a number of his story songs, but Maxine from 2001, a record he put out with Raekwon, one of the offshoot Wu-Tang Wu-Tang Clan albums. I mean, there were so many different combinations coming from that talented crew out of Staten Island. You know, so Maxine is a drug fiend, okay? So she's kind of villainous to begin with, but she decides to kill her supplier, Mooney. And she has some help, her kids. It's a family that kills together, stays together. They all throw Mooney out the window, all right? But not until after they start beating him up and pour a pot of hot grits on him. So, you know, that doesn't sound like it should be funny, right? But the way that Ghostface Killah gets into it and tells the story certainly is. There is a clean version of it, thankfully, because the dirty version we would never be able to sample. Ghostface Killah, Maxine from 2001.
Hey, yo, in Pam's house there was money missing. She was too dumb, had her nose numb. In the kitchen, her kids never ate. BCWs involved with her. Kids that she never seen shipped to the Florida. Maxine, dark-skinned, bald-headed, mean. Pants right hand, together they're the coldest fiends. Aw, guess who arrived at the door? It's Mooney, the supplier. Don't open the door. Open the door. Maxine, he gon' kill me. Chill, I got a friend cop. Girl, you don't know it's beef. Three long kicks, the hinges flew off. Kids screaming, the heavy face slap. Blew Maxine head off. It's on in the crib. You wrong for what you did. You gon' pay, Pam. That boo kiss your kids, y'all get the in the room. Do you ain't not real daddy? Next time you see my caddy, or flag me.
This is where he's up at, people's movement.
Maxine's in the kitchen crying, grits is balling on the side. She had a couple lies, somebody gotta die. Y'all smoked up my packages.
Y'all had Mac, she impacted. Swerved the Aunt May, I want mine. Pulled out the nine, get in the tub. He seen the hot iron, pulled the plug out. He stink pan, bought it back the penny on good times. Vacuum the dollar bill, he sniffed like six lines. He put his gat down, why he do that? Creeping through the crib was Maxine. Potholder down with the grits.
The one and only Ghostface Killah telling the story of Maxine, another villainous, scoundrel, shady character in music history. Have you got any candidates for that ignoble list? Leave a message on our website, soundopinions.org.
It's a good day to be, a good day for me.
That's a little bit of the song Colors by Black Pumas, a song by the Austin rock and soul duo performed earlier this year at President Joe Biden's inauguration primetime special.
Talk about a sweet gig, yeah. Mr. Cott. And in addition to that honor, Black Pumas are nominated for 3 Grammy Awards, including one for Album of the Year for their self-titled debut.
Black Pumas is made up of singer and songwriter Eric Burton and producer and guitarist Adrian Quesada. Our producer, Alex Claiborne, caught up with them last month to talk about the songs that got them hooked on Sonics, a.k.a. the music that made them want to become musicians in the first place. Let's start with producer Adrian Quesada's pick, N.W.A.'s 100 Miles and Runnin'.
My name is Adrian Quesada from Black Pumas, and I am here talk about the song. I had a hard time finding a song that I felt really made me want to be a musician, but I was kind of scanning my brain for the songs from my formative years that I felt like really had a lasting impact, and I had this memory of being a kid on my bed, and I had this little Casio keyboard, and you could program drums on it, and you could do all kinds of stuff, and I remembered, you know, we had all the NWA tapes, and there was something about the sound of it. This song in particular that I sat down on a keyboard and like dissected it in my brain, and I feel like it was maybe one of the key moments in my life where I set me up down a path as a producer. You know, there was a certain shock value, and I was from South Texas, and honestly, like some of the subject matter, even police brutality, things like that, honestly were completely over my head when I was a kid. I was in South Texas, a predominantly Mexican-American town. Obviously, there's a layers to NWA and what they were talking about at the time that is still kind of really important nowadays. Picking up a brother with an attitude confused. Yo, but Trey never had nothing to lose. One of the few that's been accused and abused of the crime of boys and young minds, but you don't know nothing till you've been in my shoes. The Trey is back from the CPT. I even was sort of familiar back then with that Dr. Dre was the producer. I remember that. I remember knowing that. And I didn't really understand what that was. But because they were sampling and creating loops, and back then there was this, that era, kind of like Public Enemy, that's some of the Dr. Dre stuff was so chaotic. The loops were not even in the same key a lot of times. There were like, you know, they would loop drums from something and then take a guitar from something else and then horns from something else, and they weren't always in the same key. But I feel like because in my formative years, I heard so much music like that. Nowadays, I kind of actually like when something's a little tiny bit left field in a song like that.
This one goes out to the four brothers from Compton. You're almost there, but the FBI has a little message for you.
By today's standards, technically, even to pull that off back then when there was limited technology, you know, we can do whatever now on Logic and GarageBand. They actually had to find the stuff back then. They had to find the perfect drum track, and then they had to find the perfect whatever. There's a saying, a friend of mine in Mexico who goes down there and studies different kind of traditional music down there, and there's a saying that they told him, some old elder musicians in Mexico said it, el chiste es hacer ruido, and that just means like, the point is to just make noise. It doesn't like translate literally, but it's like the point is just to make a sound. I feel like that kind of attitude of that early hip-hop production was one thing that I always was attracted to.
Now we'll hear from singer and songwriter Eric Burton about the song that got him hooked on Sonics.
My name is Eric Burton of the Black Pumas as well. And one song that really inspired me, kind of getting me hooked on Sonics and as well as songwriting, is a song by Greg Alexander and the New Radicals called You Get What You Give. First time I heard it, I was at a movie, Surf's Up. I was watching Surf's Up. You know, Shia LaBeouf's like playing this animated penguin, kind of surfer penguin thing. The song came on at the very end of the film, and my uncle just kind of exclaimed, like, hey man, like, that's my friend, and his voice has gotten better over the time. He sounds amazing. And we ended up going to his Malibu house like that Christmas, and you know, Greg was very encouraging of like my family to get me a guitar just to kind of get me started. And yeah, we've just kind of been close ever since. And I just love the way that he's able to, you know, kind of almost preach a message, you know, while also still being very inclusive to the masses and still yet in a lighthearted way. You know, it's like, wow, this guy is really saying some deep things, yet it's still very much palatable to many.
Health insurance with our flying, FDA, big bank is buying, fake computer crashes, dining, cloning, well, they're multiplying, fashion shoots with Beckett Hansen, Courtney Love and Marilyn Manson, you're all fixed, run to your mansions, come around, we'll kick your asses.
You know, part of entertaining and writing a song or writing a joke or whatever it is that you're presenting to someone, it's important that you learn through these people, it's important to come with the straight up truth, nothing but the truth, even if people can't handle it, to then find the balance of familiarity and finding a through line where people can receive these messages from a place of love.
Thanks to Eric Burden and Adrian Quesada of Black Pumas for talking with us about the songs that inspired them to make music. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we have a classic album dissection on the 50th anniversary of Carole King's Tapestry.
All right. For more sound opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor at soundopinions.org. That's sponsor at soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced, as always, by Andrew Gill and Alex Claiborne, and our intern is Sol Delgadillo. But you are so